Last week we had a lesson about toiling for God from the book of Nehemiah. This week we're going to have a lesson about trusting in God from the book of Esther. Maybe at some time in the future we'll have a lesson from the book of Ezra about teaching about God. Because these three books are joined together in our Bibles, there's a connection between the books. Ezra, for example, the first six chapters deal with the first return under Zerubbabel. Chapters 7 through 10 deal with the second return under Ezra. And kind of in between chapters 6 and 7 is where the book of Esther fits. During those 60 to more years in there is where that book fits. And the book of Nehemiah fits toward the end of the book of Ezra, later in the years of the return. So as we think about how these books fit together, it's kind of like pieces of a puzzle. And when we understand that this one goes with this one and how this one relates to that one, then the picture that God is trying to give us becomes more clear to us in the Old Testament and in these books. For example, the connection between Esther and Nehemiah. We think about Nehemiah going in before the king and asking the king, or he's sad in the presence of the king, and the king wants to know why he's sad, and so he tells him, and the king is going to grant him permission to go back and rebuild the walls of the city of Jerusalem. But you got to make a connection to the book of Esther, because Esther is the grandmother of the king that we're reading about in Nehemiah chapter 1. And so likely she had some influence with him, and likely she had some influence upon Nehemiah. The book of Esther is a book about trust, and Nehemiah trusts in God. But where did he get that trust? Where did he learn to trust? Well, maybe he got it from his grandmother. Maybe he saw what she did for God and how trusting and faithful she was to God, and maybe that produced that in him. I know at least in the New Testament, 2 Timothy chapter 1, that Timothy got some of his faith and some of his trust from his grandmother. So it's reasonable for us to see that in the Old Testament. But let's talk about trusting in God from the book of Esther. Now, when we look at this book, this is a difficult book. It's a dark book. We talked about some dark things this morning and how that Jesus brought light into the world. Well, the book of Esther is pretty dark. You think about the king that's ruling in the book of Esther, he's pretty fickle. I mean, he makes decisions pretty quickly, and those decisions are binding upon those that are in his kingdom. In chapter 1, he calls for the queen to come and show her beauty before the men that are gathered there. And when she refuses to do that, his advisors step in. His advisors say, this is what you ought to do. You ought to make a decree that she will be put away and somebody else will be selected in her place. And that's what he does. But by chapter 2, he's regretting that. By chapter 2, he's missing Vashti. He's wanting Vashti back, and his advisors see the difficulty there, because if he takes Vashti back, guess what Vashti is going to do? First thing she's going to do is say, get rid of all these advisors that told you to get rid of me. And so those advisors aren't going to allow that to happen, and so those advisors say, King, this is what you ought to do. You ought to have a beauty pageant. Select all the most beautiful women in the land, bring them in, and then you pick one to be her replacement. Well, that appealed to a fleshly, shallow king, and so that's what he's going to do in chapter 2. But in chapter 3, he's going to promote a very wicked man to power. That wicked man is Haman. He's going to hand his ring over to Haman, allow Haman to make whatever decisions he wants to, and Haman is about as shallow as the king is, about as wicked or evil, maybe more wicked and evil than he is. And so there's a Jew that sits in the gate, and that Jew is named Mordecai, and Mordecai refuses to bow down when Haman comes in and out. So Haman sees that, and he doesn't want to just kill Mordecai. He wants to kill all of Mordecai's people. He wants to kill all the Jews. And so he makes a decree, sends it out throughout all the land, that on a certain date all the Jews will be killed. Chapter 4 is the chapter we're going to focus on tonight. Gets a little brighter in chapter 4 because Esther's going to go in before the king and she's going to be able to make her request of the king. But there's still some dark periods in the book of Esther. For example, in Esther chapter 5, Mordecai is temporarily saved by the events that have occurred, but in chapter 5, Haman gets it in for Mordecai, and he wants him gone quickly. He's not going to wait to that day to get rid of Mordecai, and so he builds these huge gallows, planning to hang Mordecai from those gallows, and so it's still pretty dark, because here's Mordecai, his connection to Esther, and yet he's about to be put to death. And So then, we think about the events of this book. Mordecai makes this decree that all the Jews will be killed. He's got plans of getting rid of Mordecai even sooner than that. These laws that he's put into effect were laws that could not be altered. Laws of the Persians, Medes and Persians, once they were made, they were set in stone. They altered not, the Bible says. So he's made these evil decrees, and these evil decrees seem to be going to be carried out. Even after Haman is put to death, and even after things begin to clear up in the book, this law is still in effect, and the day is still coming where the enemies of the Jews are going to be able to come and attack them. So this is a book that paints a pretty dark picture, a lot of difficulties for God's people. And the message of the book of Esther is trust in God. Whatever the circumstances are, whether or not you can see God or not see God, or whether or not you hear from God or you don't hear from God, trust in God. You know, the book of Esther is a book that doesn't mention the name of God at all. But the hand of God is throughout the book of Esther. It's God working behind the scenes. It's the hand of God in the glove of history. God's working out the events of history as if you put your hand in a glove. God's doing that in the events of this book. And yet we don't read his name. We don't hear anything from him. We don't even read about prayer specifically in the book. And so we just have to trust in the midst of all of this. And so Esther chapter 4 is where we want to pick up the story, kind of giving you an overview of the book up to this point. But Esther chapter 4 is where we want to pick up. Because Esther finds out that Mordecai is sitting in the gate, and he's dressed in sackcloth and ashes. And so as a Jew, she knows something's wrong. She doesn't know what's wrong, but that's evidence that something's wrong. So she sends him a change of clothes, and he refuses them, and those clothes come back to him, and so he knows something's really wrong because he isn't just grieving, but he refuses to be comforted. So she sends her servant out to find out what the details are. That's where we want to pick up the story in Esther chapter 4. I'm trying to condense as much as I can. I feel sure that you know most of the events of the story. But I want you to look at verse 5. Then Esther called Hatak, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her. She gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. She said, you go find out what and why. You go find out why he's dressed in sackcloth and why he won't refuse refuses the clothes or the gift that I've sent to him. So he goes out to talk to Mordecai in verse 7. Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. So now we're getting the story. We're understanding why Mordecai is so upset, because there's a decree that's come out from Haman that leads to the destruction of all the Jews. And so that's why he's upset. He not only tells the messenger what is happening, he sends a copy, verse 8. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given at Shushan, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. And so here's what Mordecai does. He tells them, and then he says, here's the decree. Here's a copy of it. She might doubt what I'm saying. She might think that I've heard a rumor. She might think that I don't have credible evidence. Here's the decree from the king. The ring's pressed in it. You know it's authentic. You take it to her, and then you tell her that she needs to go to the king, and she needs to make supplication. She needs to go in and ask the king to change this, to do something about this. So that's where we are in the story. Now, when Esther gets this message back from this servant, she's going to explain to Mordecai, it's not as easy as you're making it out to be. You tell me to go into the king and make a petition for my people, but I can't do that. That's not how this works. She knows something about the government, how it works. Look at verse 11. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who had not been called, he has but one law, put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called in to go to the king these 30 days. So she says, Mordecai, you want me to go in before the king, but everybody knows you can't do that. Everybody knows the king is removed, and you have to be called into his presence, because if you go into his presence without being called, there's one law. one thing that's going to come out of that, he's going to put you to death. He doesn't let anybody come before him uncalled. He might extend the scepter, he might not. It's dangerous business to go in before the king not having been called. So Esther is explaining the situation. Mordecai is not going to give it up because he understands the consequences of no one pleading on behalf. Esther says in verse 11 as well, I've not been called in 30 days. Now, she was the favorite wife, one that was selected out of all the beautiful women in chapter 2. But we're not in chapter 2 anymore. Now we're in chapter 4. Some time has passed, and the king may have cooled a little bit in his feelings for her. 30 days, he's likely called others in, but he's not called her in. So she has reason to think, he hasn't called for me. It's been some period of time. I might not be his favorite anymore. And if I show up unannounced, that may be the end of me. That's what she's thinking about. But let's continue with the story. Look at verse 13. Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews." He said, don't think you're special. Don't think because you're in the palace, you're not going to fall in the same category as all the other Jews. Because when this decree comes down, all the Jews are going to be killed. It doesn't matter where you are. It means the ones in the palace as well as the ones outside the palace. So he's making clear to her that, you know, don't deceive yourself. Don't be fooled into thinking that you'll survive when everybody else doesn't. He says in verse 14, "For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this." So he tells Esther, he says, I have no doubt that deliverance is going to come. God is faithful and God takes care of his people. Now, God may take care of that through us, or he may take care of that through somebody else, but I know this much, if you don't speak up, that's going to be the end of us. They're going to kill me and then they're going to kill you. Now, God's still going to deliver his people, but he's not going to use us. He'll use somebody else. You know, if I choose not to work for God, I choose not to serve God, it's not going to alter God's plans. God can work it out through somebody else. It may alter my salvation. It may alter whether or not I get to go to heaven, whether or not I get used by God. But God's plans are going to go forward. They're not conditioned upon me. I'm not the only worker that God can use. I'm not the only person that God can put in that place and do the work that he wants to do. We've seen that throughout history, right? See throughout the Old Testament that God raises up those that he needs to do the work that he wants done. And if one is unwilling to do it, then God will raise up somebody else and he'll still get his work done. God is able to do that. God's not hindered by us in that sense. But notice he says, who knows if you'll come to the kingdom for such a time as this? He says, Esther, I can't make a promise to you that God has called you to do this because he hasn't told me that and he hasn't told you that. I know God and I know God's going to deliver his people and I know that God's a faithful and just God. I know God will do what's right. But Esther, who knows if that's going to be through you or that's going to be through somebody else. There's a sense in which there's comforting and there's a sense in which that's troubling because Esther's going to put her neck on the line not knowing because God has not told her whether or not he's going to do it through her or he's going to do it through somebody else. She's got to trust. She's got to be faithful to God. And so that's what Mordecai says to her. It says in verse 15, then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan, and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will lead likewise. So will I go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Now Esther says, I want you to fast for 3 days, you and all the Jews. She didn't say anything about prayer, but we have every reason to believe that's what she's talking about. Because fasting and prayer generally went together in the Old Testament. They were companions together in the Old Testament. And so she's basically telling Mordecai, I want you to spend 3 days in petitioning and asking God to bless me when I go in before. I'm going to do the same thing. My maids are going to do the same thing. And then Esther states this great statement of faith. And if I perish, I perish. But if I perish, I'm going to perish trying to save my people. If I perish, I'm going to perish trying to go in before the king and get this done. Now, if we perish, we ought to perish in the work of the Lord. If we perish, we ought to perish trying to save people. If we perish, we ought to perish trying to make a difference. What a shame it would be if we perished sitting on a pew. We perish by as a bystander rather than as a worker in God's kingdom. Esther's not going to do that. She's going to trust in God. Now, I want to give you some other examples from the Old Testament and make this point to you about trusting in God. Because Esther's one of the great examples of the Bible of this trust. She's putting herself out. She's going to go in before the king in chapter 5 unannounced. She's going to put on her best garment. She's going to wait in that court. He's going to see her, and then she's going to... Can you imagine her heart and how it's beating almost out of her chest as she's standing there thinking? He's got guards on either side of him. They may have their swords drawn. They may be ready to proceed with the execution. And there she is. She's standing there, and she's hoping, trusting that God is going to bless her actions, bless her faith. And so the king holds out his scepter. Look at chapter 5. Look at the language of the text. I love this. It's so beautiful. Verse 2. So it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court that she found favor in his sight, and the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. You see that tender moment where Esther comes in, she reaches out and she thinks, that's my life. That scepter represents my life. Fact that my life has been spared. That's the trust that she has in God. The reason why I related this story to you is because I want us to have that same kind of trust in God. I don't know what the circumstances of your life are. You don't know all the circumstances of my life. You may be dealing with a health crisis that I don't know about. You may be dealing with a marriage situation that I don't know about. You may be dealing with a situation at work or a situation at school or a situation in your life that nobody else knows about. You're the only one that knows what's going on, what's troubling you, what's bothering you. But I want to encourage you to be like Esther and trust in God. Trust in the goodness of God. Trust in the mercy of God. Trust in the help of God. Don't quit trusting in God just because you don't see His name written there for you. Don't quit trusting in God because you're not able to lay eyes on Him. Keep trusting in Him. I want you to think about some examples in the Bible where that's true. What about Job chapter 13 and verse 15? Job says, though He slay me, yet will I trust in Him. That's a lot of faith, isn't it? That's a lot of trust in God. Job says, even if God slays me, I'm going to trust in Him to the very end. I don't know why all this is happening to me. I don't know who's doing this to me. He assumed God, because of His sovereignty, must be responsible for it. So Job's saying, though He slay me, He seems to be trying to take me out. And if He is, I'm going to still trust in Him. Now, if Esther could trust in God when God hasn't told her what He's going to do, and Job can trust in God when God hasn't told him why this is going on, then don't you feel a little guilty? And don't I feel a little guilty when I don't trust in Him, when I don't have those kind of circumstances in my life? I'm not waiting to see whether or not the scepter appears, whether I live or die. I'm not facing all the problems that Job faced, and yet they both were able to trust God in the midst of those circumstances. I ought to trust God in the circumstances of my life, and you ought to do the same. Think about another example. What about David in the Psalms? Look at some verses with me. Look at Psalm chapter 11 and verse 1. Let's look at some examples from this book that kind of lay out the trust that David had in God. Because David faced a lot of difficulties as well. We'll read some of the headings to some of these Psalms because they'll tell you what David was facing at the time, or at least what we believe was going on in his life. Psalm 11 and verse 1 says it's a Psalm of David. It says, in the Lord I put my trust. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? We sing that song sometimes. Flee as a bird to the mountain, to your mountain. David says, don't say that to me. Don't tell me to flee like a bird, because I know who I put my trust in. I know He's going to be there for me. I know He's going to hold up on His side of the deal. I know that if I put my trust in Him, He's going to take care of it. But go to some later chapters. Go to Psalm 56. Psalm 56, and we want to read the heading. It says, this is a psalm of David when the Philistines captured him in Gath. So it gives you some background of it. We'll read that chapter in just a minute. But look at verse 3 of Psalm 56. Whenever I am afraid, I will trust in You. In God I will praise His word. In God I put my trust. I will not fear what flesh do to me. When I'm afraid, I'll trust in You. Let me give you the background of this. Go back to 1 Samuel 21. 1 Samuel chapter 21, we'll read verses 10 through 15. And I want you to read the occasion that's being talked about here, if the heading is right, the event of David's life. David, of course, in 1 Samuel chapter 17, kills Goliath. And you remember where Goliath was from. He was from Gath. And so David wasn't on the preferred list of those who were found in Gath. David was public enemy number one, if you will. So David's there in verse 10 of 1 Samuel 21. Then David arose and fled that day from before Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Now I want you to think about why David does this. Saul is trying to kill David because Saul is jealous of David. So David's trying to find a way to find a place where he can go where Saul won't look for him. What better place could you find than among the Philistines? Go hide among the Philistines. Saul's never going to look for you among the Philistines. He's never going to think that you would hide there. He's certainly not going to think that you're going to go to the king of Gath and hide there, because that king would want you dead more than Saul would want you dead. So he's not going to look for you there. So David's using all of his cunning ability trying to escape Saul, which tells you how bad it was. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 21, verse 11. The servants of Achish said to him, "Is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of him to one another in dances, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousand, David his 10,000s?" And David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So David was very much afraid. Now remember the words of Psalm 56, "When I am afraid, I will trust in you." So David's very much afraid, but who's he trusting in? Well, he's trusting in God. He's trusting that God's going to take care of him, that God's going to get him out of this situation. That doesn't mean that David doesn't have to do anything. It doesn't mean that David doesn't have a part to play in this. It simply means that at the end of the day, David's trust is in God, that God's going to deliver him. Look at 1 Samuel 21. Verse 12, "Now David took these words to heart and was very much afraid to Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them, pretended madness in their hands, scratched on the doors of the gate, and let his saliva fall down on his beard." David could do a lot of things. David was a mighty warrior. He was a great singer. He could play the harp. He had a lot of skills, and one of them was acting. He's pretty good at acting, because he acts like he's insane. He starts scratching on the doors. He starts slobbering, letting the saliva run down all in his beard, foaming at the mouth, if you will. Who wants to be around somebody that's crazy? And look at what the king says. I love this, because it's humorous when you really get into it and you think about it. Verse 14, "Then Achish said to his servants, 'Look, you see the man is insane. Why have you brought him to me? Why did you bring a crazy man to me?'" It's as if the king's saying, "I've got enough crazy people around me. I don't need another one. I certainly don't need one from Israel." It says in verse 15, "Have I need of madmen that you brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? You think I want this madman in my house? You think I want him scratching on my doors? You think I want his saliva all over my furniture? No, I don't want this madman in my house. Get him out of here." So David's going to get away. But don't forget Psalm 56. David said, "When I'm afraid, I'll trust in you." I've told you before that during the Revolutionary War, there was a saying, "Trust in God and keep your powder dry." They had a responsibility of keeping their powder dry, but they were trusting in God to deliver them and help them to win. And I believe that He did. We have a part to play. David had a part to play, but ultimately our trust is in God. Look at Psalm 57. Let's continue, and we'll see another occasion in David's life where David puts his trust in God. This is a psalm of David when he fled from Saul into the cave. So it says in verse 1, "Be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for my soul trusts in you. In the shadow of your wings I'll make my refuge until these calamities have passed by." Until these calamities have passed by. We sometimes sing, till the storm does what? Passes over. What are we going to do? We're going to trust in God until the storm passes over. We're going to take refuge underneath the wings of God. We're going to shelter in God, and we're going to wait out the storm. We're going to let the storm pass over, trusting in God. Saul was a storm, and he was circling like a tornado all out in the wilderness, trying to find David. David's sheltering in God. He's waiting and trusting in God. Look at Psalm 62, another psalm that talks about David and his trust in God. Psalm 62. Look at verse 8. Trust in Him at all times, you people. Pour out your heart before Him. God is a refuge for us. Trust in Him at all times. That's the trust we're talking about. Now, if Esther could trust in God, and Job could trust in God, and David could trust in God when they had worse circumstances than we do, and they had less revelation about what to do and what not to do than we have, then why can't we trust in God? Why do we get so uptight and we struggle so much with the little things of our lives? When they had big things that they were dealing with, and they were still trusting in God, where God hadn't said anything, as far as we know, to Esther. She's going to put her life on the line of going before the king. Job doesn't know why it's happening, but he's still trusting in God. David doesn't know. Why is Saul chasing me everywhere? Why is everybody trying to kill me? David doesn't know the answer to all of that, but he's still trusting God. Let's go to another one. Let's go to the New Testament. Let's go to Acts chapter 27. I like this chapter because this chapter is from the life of Paul. And Paul's another great example of trust, because Paul finds himself in Acts chapter 27, and he's in a huge storm. And he didn't want to be in the storm. He warned them not to sail at this time of the year, but they don't listen to him because he's a prisoner. So they get themselves in this storm. Look at verse 14, and I want you to read the conditions that he's in. It says, "But not long after, a tempestuous wind, a headwind, rose called Euroclydon." So there's a tempestuous wind. That sounds like that's a lot of fun, right? You're in a boat and there's a tempestuous wind. That sounds like a lot of fun. That's where he is. He says in the next verse, "So when the ship was caught," that's a lot of fun too, right? The ship is caught. What does it mean that the ship is caught? It means that the ship got caught in the wind. Look at what it says at the last part of the verse. It says, "Caught and could head into the wind. We let her drive." Anytime you let her drive, there's a problem. Now, I'm not talking about your wife, or I'm not talking about your daughters. But when you let the wind drive, you're in trouble, right? When you're in a boat and you're not driving the boat anymore, the wind is driving the boat, the wind is deciding which direction you go and how fast you go, that's not a good thing. That's like a car without brakes, right? You got a car without brakes, that's not a good situation, because the car is deciding how fast you go and where you go. That's not a good situation. That's the situation they're in. But look at the words. Look at the language. It says, "And sailing under shelter of an island called Clauda, we secured the skiff with difficulty." Now, there's that word difficulty. Again, they're facing a lot. Verse 17, "When they had taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship, and fearing," now we got fear, "lest they should run aground." Now they're worried about running aground. And again, we're told they were driven. Verse 18, "Because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed." Sounds like fun. "The next day, they lightened the ship." Now, why do you lighten a ship? Because it's sitting too low in the water. Now, why does it matter if it's sitting too low in the water? Because if it's sitting too low in the water can come in. So you got to get some of the weight off the ship so it sits higher in the water so the waves don't come in as easily. So they're lightening the ship. Now, what does it mean they're lightening the ship? It means they're throwing things off the ship. What kind of things are you throwing off the ship? What things you put on the ship? Why don't you put them on the ship? Because you wanted them? Because they were going to serve a purpose? Because they were going to make you some money? But now you're getting rid of them. It tells you you're facing some difficulties if you're lightening the ship. It says in verse 19, "On the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard." Now they're lightening the ship even more, but this time they're not throwing off the extras. They're not throwing off the products that they were planning on selling when they got to port or trade. Now they're throwing off the tackling of the ship. Don't you need that? Isn't there a reason why that's on the boat to begin with? Well, sure there is, but if it comes to sinking or comes to surviving, you get rid of the things that you might need otherwise. You know, you get rid of the things that are on there for a purpose, but they're heavy. Get rid of them so it sits lighter in the water. That's what they're doing. So the wind's really in charge now because they're getting rid of any control that they have. Notice it says in verse 20, "Now when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days." Imagine being on a boat in the middle of a storm. You've cast off everything you know to cast off, and you're not seeing the sun or the stars for days. Now remember, how did they sail? What did they use to guide them? Well, they used the stars. They don't have those anymore, but they're not in charge anymore anyway. The wind's driving. The wind's determining where they go. And so that's the situation they're in. It says, "But after long..." He says in verse 20, "Tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up." Got to a point to where all hope was lost. They knew the ship was going down. Look at the language. It says, "And after abstinence of food..." Why do you think they're not eating? Did they throw the food overboard? Maybe. Or maybe the boat is so tempest-tossed, you can't eat and keep it down. Maybe it's a situation where he's fasting and praying. I don't know for sure, but I know that there's a period of time where he's not eating anything. That's the difficulty that he's in. Then we get down to the context of his trust. Verse 22, "And now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life of you, but only of the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of God, to whom I belong and to whom I serve, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed God has granted you all those that sail with you. Therefore take heart, men..." What he says, "For I believe God that it will be just as he told me." Paul says, "I trust God. I'm in a storm. The ship is kind of being driven by the wind. I can't control it. We've done everything within our power to lighten it. We haven't seen the stars or the moon for a number of days. All hope's been given up." But he says, God said nobody's going to lose their life. God didn't say it wasn't going to be difficult, because God said the boat's going to be lost. But if you're on the boat and the boat's going to be lost, guess what? That means you're going to end up in the water. You're not going to die, but you're going to be in the water. And Paul's going to talk about in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, the night and the day and the deep. He's going to be floating on a board for some time, but he's going to be okay. Everybody's going to be okay. They're going to be spared. Think about trusting in God. Here's Esther, here's Job, here's David, here's Paul. They all trust in God in circumstances probably worse than any circumstances that I'm facing or you're facing. Still trusting in God. That tells me I ought to trust in God. So how did it work out for Esther? How did it work out for Job? How did it work out for David? How did it work out for Paul? Well, ultimately, it worked out okay for them because they put their trust in God. Notice a few verses with me. Isaiah 26. We'll notice a couple of verses from Isaiah and a couple from Jeremiah, and then the lesson will be yours. But Isaiah chapter 26, would you look at what Isaiah says about trusting in God. Isaiah 26 and verse 3 and 4. It says, "You will keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on you, because he trusts in you. Trust in the Lord forever, for in Yah the Lord is everlasting strength." So God's going to keep those in perfect peace who trust in him. That's Philippians chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. "Casting all your care upon him," the idea of praying to God, making your supplications and prayers known to God. And what will God give you? God will guard your hearts and minds and give you a peace that passeth all understanding. Here's the peace we're talking about. God will give you peace. But notice Isaiah 31, going quickly, listening a few more verses. Isaiah 31, verse 1. It says, "Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses, who trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong, but who do not look to the Holy One of Israel nor seek the Lord." Isaiah was dealing with people that instead of trusting in God, they were trusting in the Egyptians, or they were trusting in the Assyrians, or they were trusting in somebody else to come to their aid or help them. And Isaiah says, "Woe to those that trust in horses and chariots and horsemen rather than in God. I'd be the first to tell you that I believe in a strong defense of our nation. I believe we ought to have all the planes and all the tanks and all the ships and all the guns and all the everything that we can. I believe in that. I'd rather spend money on that than some of the things we spend money on. Now, I'm not for the $5 million hammers or whatever they cost. Not for that, but I am for defending our nation. I think we need to do that. But if we're trusting in those things to deliver us, that's mighty foolish. Because we ought to be trusting in God to deliver us. Every nation that forgets God, we cast into hell, Psalm 9:17 says. That includes our nation. Righteousness exalts the nation, but sins are reproached to any people. We want our nation to be spared and saved. We better be on God's side rather than worrying about how many tanks we have or how many planes we have or how many ships we have. We do our part. We're wise in our stewardship of the blessings that God's given us. We do everything we can do within our power. But ultimately, it comes down to when God wants us to fall, we'll fall. I don't care if we got more tanks. I don't care if we have more planes. I don't care if we have more boats. I don't care if we have more guns. It's not going to matter. God decides we're going to fall, we're going to fall. So we better stand with Him and be for Him. But that's what Isaiah is talking about. Let's go to Jeremiah very quickly. Jeremiah 17, let's finish up in Jeremiah 17, 5 through 7. It says, "Thus saith the Lord, cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength, whose heart departs from the Lord. For he shall be like a shrub in the desert, shall not see when good comes, but shall inhabit the parched places in the wilderness, in a salt land which is not inhabited. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord and whose hope is in the Lord, for he shall be like a tree planted by the waters, which spreads out its roots by the river and will not fear when heat comes, but its leaf will be green, will not be anxious in the year of drought, nor will cease from yielding fruit." And so he gives two examples, the man who doesn't trust in God, the man who does. One's like a shrub in the desert that doesn't get any water, and the other one is planted by the waters, gets plenty, continues to be fruitful. So we get to decide whether we're going to be a tree planted by the rivers of water or we're going to be a tumbleweed. We're either one. If we don't trust in God, we're a tumbleweed. We're going to be dead and dry up and we're going to be blown about. We trust in God, we'll take root. God will make sure we stand. God will take care of us. We just need to trust in God. That's the point of the lesson. And that's the illustration from the book of Esther is, Esther was willing to trust in God, and God used her to give her people deliverance. What can God do through you and through me if we'll trust in Him? Who can God deliver through us? Who can God save through us? What difference can God make through us? But it comes down to whether or not we will trust in Him, rely upon Him. Tonight, if you're not a Christian, we invite you to become one. The book of Esther is all about trust, trusting in God. Do you trust in God? Will you take God at His word that when you believe and repent and confess and you're buried in water, that He'll take away your sins and He'll add you to the church? Are you trusting God to do that? And if you have done that in the past, do you trust in God enough to live faithful every day, to make decisions in your life not based on fear, not based on the pressure of outside forces or outside circumstances, but you trust in God? And you do what God tells you to do, believing that God will help you and take care of you. You need to come tonight. We invite you to as we stand and as we sing.